Welcome to the program. I'm Jeff Sheckman. Because the topic has been entangled in cultural and political debates, the true economic and social impacts of marriage, child-rearing, class, and success, measured from a sociological perspective, have often been overlooked. My guest today, Professor Melissa Kearney, aims to change that narrative with her work and her new book, The Two-Parent Privilege. Kearney has dedicated over a decade to researching the seismic shifts in American family life. She has delved deep to uncover how the decline in marriage rates, especially among those without a college degree, is not merely a cultural issue, but an economic crisis in disguise. In a society where only 63% of children now live with married parents, down from 77% in 1980, Kearney argues that the absence of a stable two-parent household has far-reaching consequences. This is not just about pooled income or tax benefits. It's about the holistic development of our children and the future of our country. But this conversation goes beyond mere trends. It's about the tangible impact on children who grow up in single-parent homes, who often face more behavioral problems and achieve lower educational levels. It's about the widening class divide where college-educated adults continue to marry and raise children in stable homes while others don't, and the repercussions are felt by the children, the family, and even the men who are left behind. This is not a political debate. Kearney eschews the religious and values-based arguments that have long dominated this conversation. She chooses instead to focus on the economic imperatives that we can no longer afford to ignore. Melissa Kearney is an economics professor at the University of Maryland, and her new book is The Two-Parent Privilege, How Americans Stopped Getting Married and Started Falling Behind. Melissa Kearney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it is a delight to have you here. Given that there is so much research that indicates, if nothing else, that marriage functions as a positive economic vehicle within families, talk a little bit about how that runs so counter to what we've seen in the drop-off in marriage rates, especially among those in lower economic categories.
It is a bit surprising when you think about how protective marriage is as an economic institution, to the extent that it brings the resources of two adults, or, you know, more specifically in the case of kids, two parents into a home. It is somewhat surprising that as economic situations have gotten more challenging, inequality has widened, the sort of, you know, gaps between what it takes to really set up a very successful resource-filled life for oneself and one's child or children, that we have seen this really large decline in marriage, again, outside the college-educated class. But I think it reflects both, you know, changing economics and changing social structures. And so even though it makes people actually more economically vulnerable to be setting up households by themselves, in a large sense, the challenging economic situation facing a lot of people is part of the driving force that's led to this situation. Somewhat counterproductively, but that's exactly why I think this issue is both reflecting the forces that have driven widening inequality and class gaps in our society, but also amplifies them.
It is, as you say, sort of self-perpetuating in so many ways. Is there something about contemporary marriage that has become more complicated in some respects that is driving this? What do you see as the drivers for this?
So I lean pretty heavily at the end of the day, based on my reading of the situation and the studies and the data, I lean pretty heavily into a role for economic changes in driving this. So let me be specific about what I'm referring to. Let's start back. In the 60s and 70s, there were a lot of social changes, a relaxation of norms around marriage, around having kids outside marriage. And what we saw in the 60s and 70s was a decrease in marriage across the education distribution. Men and women of all education levels were less likely to be married at the end of those decades than at the beginning. But then in the 80s and 90s, we saw a real divergence, such that the decline in marriage among college-educated, the most educated adults in society, stopped its decline and really stabilized. But among adults outside the college-educated class, we saw rates of marriage continue a straight line down. And I think a lot, you know, again, based on my read of the evidence and the data, that what happened was during the 80s and 90s, the economic position of non-college educated men, both in an absolute sense and relative to women, declined. And in a very unromantic view of marriage, that does make the economic value proposition of the institution erode a bit. And so what do I mean by that? I mean, people looking at marriage as I'm trying to find a partner who not only makes me happy, but is a stable financial, reliable financial contributor to our home, to our household, to our family, if we have kids. As women started doing better economically with more opportunities, more labor force participation, at the same time as men, again, without four-year college degrees is where we saw this happening, men saw their employment rates decline, their earnings stagnate. The desirability of pairing up with one of these men, you know, was reduced. And we can also think about this happening from the men's point of view as their economic situation became more fragile, less secure. They might have decided they were less willing or able to commit to taking care of a family. So I don't want to, you know, I think we also have studies showing that there's a causal link here. So again, I'll be specific. In communities where there was a loss of well-paying manufacturing jobs, those were very nice family sustaining wages for non-college educated men in particular. In communities where there was a loss of such jobs, we saw that there was an increase in the share of children born outside of marriage and ultimately the share of kids living with a single mother. So we have evidence suggesting that there's a causal link here between both men's economic position and their economic position relative to women and changes in marriage. And so I think that is part of the story, but it's not the full story. It's how people respond to economic situations given social conventions. And so the changing social norms here are also quite important.
It is ironic with respect to the social norms that the groups in the 60s and 70s that really led the movement in many ways to change social norms, and in some ways at that point in time against marriage, really were the college-educated group that later embraced marriage more aggressively.
It's so interesting and important to make this distinction, because one of the reactions that I'm getting to my book is that marriage is fundamentally incompatible with feminist ideals and women's economic liberation. And one of the facts I keep coming back to is that actually women who have benefited the most from that, and by which I'm referring to women who have done, you know, very well economically, earned high levels of education, are themselves most financially, you know, secure, have the highest earnings, highest levels of educational attainment, they're the ones who really are still at rates very similar to 40 years ago, getting married and raising their kids in two-parent homes. And so I take away from that marriage is not fundamentally in opposition to a feminist success. And in fact, what we're seeing, millions of moms in particular raising their kids in one-parent households, is really not a feminist success story, right? I mean, in some sense, we should acknowledge that the liberation, the economic liberation of women and their ability to have their own money has freed women from having to be in abusive or harmful relationships. And of course, that is a great part of the success here. But the millions of women who are finding themselves doing this alone, setting up their own household with limited resources, we should not kid ourselves into thinking that that's a feminist success story.
Is there something that we're missing in terms of the nature of marriage itself today? That in those marriages among college-educated couples, that the nature, the fundamental nature of marriage and the way the relationship operates works differently than in a traditional arrangement, and that that's a lot of where the divide is, that that non-college educated couples don't see marriage in the same way and are not able to function within it in a more contemporary way.
So this raises a host of really interesting, important questions that my work on this raises in my mind, and I don't have answers to. But I think that, you know, the interesting question here is, why does it seem to be the case that college-educated men and women have been more inclined, or we could think about this as more able, to actually have what we would think of as modern marriages, given the realities of a majority of women, a majority of moms working now? And to be clear, I'm completely agnostic in my research and in the book about how families make it work and whether one parent is staying home or one parent, you know, both parents are working full time or part time, or someone's working part time throughout a kid's childhood. I don't distinguish between those arrangements, because the way I think of this is any two parent setting has more choices and options available to them than a one parent setting. And so I don't try to categorize couples in doing it that way, but I think it raises an interesting question as to, are college educated men, for whatever reason, in practice, more likely or willing to share in household tasks or childcare, or, you know, spending time with their kids, than outside the college-educated class? And that's why marriage feels like a more attractive institution? Or is it the question of, you know, college-educated parents are more likely to recognize how beneficial this is to their children and see a commitment to making their relationship or marriage work as a way of preserving their family and their child's economic success? A lot of those questions come into play as to why do we see this huge divide. On a very practical level, one of the things I can see in the data and the studies on all of this is that outside the college-educated class, there are just a lot of practical barriers that adults seem to face in making a stable, long-term relationship work. Things like economic stability, engagement with the criminal justice system, meaning one of the parents is in and out of prison or has a criminal record that makes stable employment hard. When there's a lack of employment, there's also more likely to be depression, anxiety, substance abuse. We also know, and this gets to the intergenerational component of all this, that a lot of these unmarried couples with lower levels of education were not themselves raised in married two-parent homes. And so that missing that example also makes it harder to know how to navigate the complications of a relationship. And so we could speculate about some of these stories about, you know, willingness to sort of really be a partner. But I also think there's just a lot of practical barriers that more economically vulnerable or less highly educated groups are facing, that is part of the explanation for why we're seeing lower rates of marriage and higher shares of one-parent homes among those adults.
I mean, it almost makes, to be a little flip about it, it makes marriage today kind of a luxury good.
100%. I completely agree. And that is why, you know, I refer to this as a privilege in the title of my book. And by the way, this is why people should recognize this issue really in terms of class gaps and a threat to equity, in the sense that the most advantaged groups in society are the ones who are most likely to have the benefits and the advantages of a married partner, a resident co-parent, helping them create and sustain a very highly resourced household for themselves and their children. And so this really is yet another advantage or luxury good of the college-educated class in America. So everybody who is concerned about widening class gaps, about the college class pulling away from everyone else, about the preponderance of resources that they are devoting to their kids, which perpetuates advantage and disadvantage at the other end across the generations. Everyone who's concerned about those class gaps should be concerned about this issue as well, right? Like, we want everyone to have access to high levels of high quality education. We want everyone to have access to high quality, affordable childcare. We want everybody to have access to high quality healthcare. I think we should also want everybody to be able to achieve a safe, stable, enriching family life.
How much of it is driven by where people live? How much does that make a difference, are you finding in your research?
I'm finding very similar trends over the past 40 years across all regions of the country, and like strikingly similar trends between urban and rural areas.
Talk a little bit about the definition of marriage. And as you talk to people on both the college-educated side and the non-college-educated side, do they define marriage the same way? Do they think about it and talk about it the same way?
This is another really interesting question that gets into a lot of nuance that, quite honestly, my broad-brush economic data-driven lens sort of sets aside. I define marriage in the census based on whether two people report that they're married. And I don't distinguish between whether they are opposite or same sex. And so really the trends that I'm tracking in parental marriage are really just about whether two people are legally married. What's interesting though is that raises the question of why don't I treat cohabiting parents or an unmarried parent with a partner in their household as a married couple? And the answer is, as a practical matter, in the U.S., unmarried cohabiting parents do not look like married parents to the, you know, in the main way is they don't stay together very long. So first, there's actually much less cohabitation between parents than unmarried parents than I think is commonly assumed. Mm-hmm. So let me be clear. 30% of kids now live with married parents. 21% live with an unpartnered mother, meaning a mom who has neither a spouse nor someone she refers to as her partner in the census in her household. And only about 8% of kids live with one of their parents and their parents' partner. But we know from studies that track kids over the course of their lives, those are very fragile arrangements. And most of those unmarried cohabiting parents will not be together throughout the childhood. And so that's why marriage itself seems to be different in a very practical way in terms of the kinds of household family structure it delivers to children. To the extent that couples consider themselves married, but they aren't officially married, that would show up in the data as unmarried parents. And so the fact that we do observe such large gaps in kids' outcomes based on whether they are living in a married parent or unmarried parent situation, the fact that we observe such large gaps means that all the other things that parents are doing to make up for not being married, whether it's, cohabiting or having a grandparent live with them or co-parenting just in a non-resident sense, it's not actually delivering the same kinds of benefits that a married parent home tends to deliver, because I'm using those really very specific crude definitions when I look at the gap.
Talk about the benefits, not just to kids and the economic benefits, but the benefits in terms of well-being, happiness, et cetera, the other sociological benefits to the couples themselves.
This is an area that a lot of other people have looked at. It's a bit distinct, though highly related to what I'm talking about, because I just want to be clear. I'm really drawing on very clear data and studies that I find extremely compelling, showing that a married two-parent home delivers a lot of benefits to kids. But there is work separate from the research that I've done or review suggesting that marriage is also very protective and helpful to adults' levels of happiness, men in particular, their health as they age, all of that feels very plausible to me. I will say, I haven't dug in to that evidence and research base as closely to be as confident that that is causal, as opposed to, you know, the types of people who manage to stay married or be married, whether they would have been in better health or have higher levels of happiness. So I find it all very plausible. There are a lot of mechanisms through which we might expect that to happen. But that is, you know, something that I'm less confident about, mm-hmm. which is why it's, you know, a separate issue that I hope to learn more about.
Right. Except that, I mean, as part of that, that the happiness of the parents, the well-being of the parents, does filter down in terms of the outcomes for the kids, or at least one would assume that.
We certainly know, or have lots of evidence, to suggest that levels of stress are higher in single-parent households. And I think it's really not hard for any of us to understand why that might be. If you are the only parent responsible for paying the bills, taking care of the kids, supervising the kids, cleaning the house, right, preparing the meals, of course, that's very stressful. And single-parent households are much more likely to be under-resourced because you only have one adult bringing resources and income into the household. And a lower level of resources, lower level of income, often means that there's higher levels of what is sometimes called toxic stress mm-hmm. in psychology, or what behavioral economists have referred to as limited cognitive bandwidth. So there are higher levels of stress. And then we also know from evidence that that makes it harder for parents to parent the way they want to. I think this does raise a really interesting point that is challenging and somewhat controversial, but a lot of people bristle at this notion that it's good for parents to stay together for their kids because if parents aren't happy, that's not good for kids. I want to be very, very clear. Nothing I say or write in this book should be misconstrued as suggesting that where there's violence or abuse or harm, it would be beneficial for kids if the parents stayed together. But the evidence about parental separation and divorce for kids, a lot of those divorces are not because of outright abuse. Maybe one parent sort of got tired of the relationship or had an extramarital affair, or there's other reasons why parents split up that maybe promotes the parents' happiness. But my read of the evidence on the impact of kids is that then the lower levels of resources coming into the home, which does, you know, as we were saying, translate into not just lower levels of material resources, which is true, but also less parental time and energy and emotional nurturing for the kids. That on net, on average, seems to be disadvantageous for the children.
One of the things about this, besides the economic dollars and cents nature of it, that it does seem that in terms of encouraging marriage, there's not a lot that's ever been done or that maybe can be done with respect to public policy to help this. Talk about that.
So I think it is a very naive read of the situation to take away from this. We just need more people to make different decisions, as if there aren't real barriers that are keeping a lot of these adults from being married. And so the right way to think of this is really 40% of kids in the U.S. now are born to unmarried parents. Oh, 30% of kids in the U.S. now are raised outside a two-parent setting. In some of those situations, parents might sort of be ambivalent, agnostic about whether they're married or not. And some nudging from community norms or social norms saying, hey, you should really try to make this work. It's going to be easier on everyone, better for the kids if you guys get married and try to make this work as a family. That might be helpful for some set of these couples. On the other end, of course, as we said, there are some couples who should absolutely not be together, and we would never want to encourage them to be married. My read of the evidence, including a lot of survey evidence and ethnographic evidence and interviews with some of these unmarried low-income couples in particular, is that there are real barriers for them forming healthy, stable relationships. And what we need to be doing is meeting them where they are, saying why, you know, you guys say you want to be together. You want to co-parent the children as a family. What are the barriers? And what are the kinds of things we see in these studies? We see unstable employment, substance abuse, criminal background. We see people that struggle with communication, who themselves did not grow up in two-parent homes, don't really know how to make a marriage work. We should be investing in these community programs. And when I say we, I mean we need more public dollars, philanthropic investment, research dollars, going to programs that meet families where they are and help strengthen them by actually addressing the barriers that are keeping them from creating a safe and stable two-parent home. In terms of public policy, there are obvious sort of low-hanging fruit things we could do, like removing the marriage disincentives from the tax code or from our design of income transfer programs. We should remove those marriage disincentives, which are sort of all over the tax code and transfer program design. Why are they there? Because when we try to target income redistribution to low-income households, as households make more money, they lose their benefits, their taxes go up. But one of the ways that households make more money is essentially to have, you know, to get married or to have the adults get married or have two people. And that means that they lose, you know, those couples, if you take two, let's say two parents, they're each making $25,000, $30,000. They're not married. They're more likely to qualify for government assistance or tax credits. And so we should remove those disincentives. My reading of that is that it will have some effect on the margin. It's not going to dramatically turn things around, because I don't think, again, based on the evidence, that what's driven this really large increase in the share of one-parent homes outside the set of adults who have a college degree, I don't think it's just the discouragement from the design of tax and transfer programs, but that's an obvious thing we should be doing.
And finally, talk a little bit about the reaction that you have gotten to this book and to these ideas.
So I am very, very bolstered by the reaction I've gotten from scholars who know these issues very well, which is, I'm glad you put out this book. I know people are mad at you, but this really is something we have to talk about. I'm also very bolstered by the fact that, again, I haven't gotten any sort of serious criticism from scholars who know this work very well, saying, hey, you missed this, like you missed this set of studies. And so that makes me feel like the evidence I'm putting out there is right. I'm also very bolstered by all of the reactions I've gotten from single parents, mostly, you know, sort of economically vulnerable single parents, or people who work with fragile families in a variety of community programs, people who work with non-resident dads trying to help them with sort of responsible fatherhood, as it's called, from people who work in schools saying, this is exactly what I've been seeing for the past 25 years. Thank you for putting out this book. I'm really bolstered by those reactions. On the other side, I've gotten a lot of criticism that I fully expected from people who are offended by the mere suggestion that single parent, and in particular single mother households, are disadvantaged. And I think, you know, this is expected because nobody wants to sound like, and I certainly don't want to sound like, I'm blaming single moms. But the reality is that while we all know single moms who are highly resourced, and of course, there are lots of children who have done phenomenally well raised by single mothers, it's really undeniable that many single mothers find this a very precarious situation, and they tend to be less resourced than their married counterparts. And so while it's frustrating to get that pushback, it's entirely expected. And frankly, I think it's just counterproductive to acknowledging the class gaps in all of this and the very real challenges that millions of single parents and their kids are facing.
Melissa Kearney. The book is The Two-Parent Privilege, How Americans Stopped Getting Married and Started Falling Behind. Melissa, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks again for having me on.
Thank you.